This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
So I believe the United States should abolish the death penalty. The Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, and this is both cruel and unusual and unjustly implemented. People of color are vastly overrepresented on death row.
I would not support abolishing the death penalty, at least at the federal level, and forcing that on states. I believe this is ultimately a state's decision, and you cannot say it is not constitutional for the death penalty, in that when the founders wrote the Constitution, clearly they were doing capital punishment, and it was the spirit of those founders.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, good afternoon. We'll talk about the spirit of our founders today. We'll talk about the spirit of 1776. We'll take a look at the importance of virtue, and I'll bring you up to speed on what is some breaking news. We'll get to that in a minute, though. Attorney General Merrick Garland, he has suspended federal executions. And joining me in a little while, Monsignor Stuart Sweatland will be by. We've talked about this issue a lot together, and Monsignor sees a real evolution in the church's theology on this, and I'm sure he will celebrate that. We'll talk about suspension of federal executions. You know, the Trump administration decided to take a different tact on that. I'm glad. I think it's a good decision. But I do want to talk also about our nation today, and I'd love to hear from you. If you want to join me, you're always welcome. It's always good to sit across the table from you here and just have a conversation. The number's 888-914-9149. Feel free to dial in anytime, okay? 888-914-9149. We're going to take a look at civics, how well Americans know the knowledge of their history and how government works. We're going to also take a look a little bit later on the spiritual founding of our republic. And I really believe this personally, that God had his fingers on the founding of this country. I know there's been some real dark chapters in U.S. history. We know what happened to Native Americans. We know what happened when the conquistadors came to the Americas. We know a lot of things. But we also know the beauty of evangelization. We also know the country that we now live in, the form of government that we have, the liberties that we enjoy. And there were some very peculiar, I think, divine events during not only the Revolutionary War, but during the whole process of our founding that, to me, reflect the fingerprints of God on the great mission he set before this great nation. So we'll get into that coming up a little bit later. But you know, I was last night, as I was answering some show email, I was also reading a little bit about Charles Carroll. And you probably know that name. One of the great signers of the Constitution. He was the only Catholic signer of the Constitution. I thought, you may not know this, so let me share with you a little history here. And today maybe we'll do that. We'll share some American history. Sunday, of course, we celebrate the 245th anniversary of Independence Day. 5 years from now, we're going to be celebrating that 250, which is a significant anniversary here for our country. But it's an important day for us, not just as Americans. I think it's an important day for you and for me as Catholics. You know, at the beginning of the colonial period, colonies did not tolerate Catholics. There was great prejudice against Catholics. Catholics weren't welcome, really. You know, they were considered papists, and the secular leaders, who were also, you know, very often religious leaders, they would not allow for popery, you know, to have any chance of getting established. And Maryland, the great state of Maryland, right, a beautiful state, was initially established as a colony where Catholicism would be allowed. Of course, that didn't last for long. And soon Catholics weren't able to hold, you know, any public office or even vote. Can you imagine that? You talk about discrimination. If you're a Catholic, you can't represent, you can't hold any public office, you don't even have a voice, you can't vote because you're Catholic, right? So growing up in this atmosphere, there was a young man, his name was Charles Carroll, and he and his family were Catholics. They lived in Annapolis, Maryland, and despite the oppression of their faith, they were able to flourish. And again, I see God's fingerprints on this. His cousin John would become the first bishop in this new country, Bishop John Carroll, a lot of schools named after him, right? Charles was sent to Europe to be educated. When he got back to the U.S., it was time for him to see and to experience really the effect of the Stamp Act. A little history for you. The Stamp Act was passed back in 1765, and it came at the end of that seven-year war with France and Britain. And the British coffers, of course, were depleted from the war. So what happened? British Parliament, they passed a tax, you know, and they wanted to tax, you know, all paper documents in the colonies. But, of course, there was no one in Parliament to represent the colonies, which is why there was, you know, there were uprisings up and down the whole eastern seaboard. The slogan, no taxation without representation. That's where that originally came from. You know, but a year later, the act was repealed. It was a key factor, though, in the start of the revolution 10 years later. So, you know, back to Charles Carroll, he quickly became recognized as a voice, you know, calling for independence from the British crown. And part of the reason for that is because, and try to get your head around what I'm going to tell you here. Charles Carroll was one of the wealthiest men in the colonies, right? One of the wealthiest men in the colonies. I saw two numbers earlier today. One said he was worth about $2 million, okay? That's in 1776 dollars, right? $2 million. He owned 10,000 acres. He had plantations. He had all sorts of things. They estimate that his wealth would have been worth probably $500 million. A half a billion. His estate was 10,000 acres. It included slaves, but, you know, he was not a fan of slavery. He was in favor of abolition of slavery, and he never wanted to separate families. And he also advocated for a law that would free female slaves at the age of 28. He was a good man. He was a good Catholic. And, you know, he had more than anything else to lose. Think about that. $500 million. You know, that's a ton of money to go up against the crown, to be part of the revolution. He also was a very effective writer and speaker, and like our founding fathers, and what an amazing time that was. I mean, look at the eloquence of Thomas Jefferson. Look at the minds of John Adams. You know, take a look at the heroism of men like Washington. It was an anointed time, a special time, you know. And like our founding fathers, he started writing newspapers under a pseudonym, and his pseudonym, kind of cool. He called himself First Citizen, but as soon as identity was discovered, and he was soon thrust into the forefront of the leaders advocating for a new country. And he was actually selected to go to Canada. He went up to Quebec along with his cousin and Benjamin Franklin to try to strike an alliance with the French in that colony. They knew war was coming. So things changed very drastically, very dramatically, really, for him. From not being able to vote, right, never mind hold a public office, Charles Carroll was selected to represent the state of Maryland, the colony of Maryland, Maryland at the Second Continental Congress, which produced the Declaration, right? The Declaration of Independence. And after the war, he was elected to be the first senator of Maryland. But, you know, he outlived John Adams. He outlived Thomas Jefferson. And you probably know this. If you don't, I think it's one of the coolest aspects of our founding. Another one of those really weird little bits of history. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, they both died on the 50th anniversary of the adoption of the Declaration. July 4th, they died. They died July 4th, 1826. And, you know, they had been at odds at each other for quite a while. But in the end, they wrote to one another. And God called them home on the very same day. You know, Charles Carroll, he died at the age of 95. He was the last signer of the Constitution to be called home. He died in 1832. He lived to be 95 years old. And if you just think about our country at that time, I mean, despite being, you know, what, about 2% of the population in the colonies at the time, Catholics were extremely influential in what happened with the Revolution, with the Revolutionary War, and with our drive for independence, and really the establishment of this great republic that we call America today. I mean, Charles Carroll is just one of them. He's just one of them. If you read more books like Liberty's Lion, and you can get that from Sophia Press, or there's another book that I came across called Continental Ambition and Continental Achievement. That's from Ignatius. I think you'll find them very telling and very revealing. So Charles Carroll, one of the great founders. I'll share with you more coming up a little bit later on some of the other men who risked everything for the independence, the freedom, and the liberties that you enjoy. I stumbled across this, and I was struck by it. It opened my eyes. I think it might do the same thing for you. But of course, Monsignor Stuart Sweatland is going to be joining me here in just a minute. And I want to talk to him about what is so critical for the future of this nation. And I have not fear. I don't want to say fear. I have trepidation, maybe. I have a little hesitancy right now when I see people wanting to burn the flag when they win an Olympic medal or turning their back on our national anthem or I see the disrespect, the lack of virtue that is exemplified in the hearts of so many Americans. Because if we want America to survive, if we want it to prosper, then we must be a virtuous people. You know, a government that encourages vice is a nation that's going to be doomed. That's my personal take on that. So when you are pushing the Equality Act, when you're dealing with all this transgender, gender fluidity stuff, when you're killing children, when you're redefining marriage, this is not the America of our founding fathers. It isn't. This is not the America of our founding fathers. It's changing. And look, I'm not saying we've lost it. There's a lot we can do. You know, I often remember the famous phrase when Ben Franklin was leaving Independence Hall after, you know, the final day of deliberation in 1787. And, you know, I think it was a woman or somebody shouted out to him, "Dr. Franklin, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And he turned around and he said to them, "We've got a republic, if you can keep it." So what did he mean by that? You know, he was saying, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. And as nations become more corrupt and vicious, he says they have more need of masters. And I think we see that today. Sunday's July 4th. You know, this year it'll be more normal than last year. Last year, you might remember, because of coronavirus, fireworks displays were canceled all across the country and major festivities and celebrations were also canceled. But the coronavirus wasn't the only issue. We had the death of George Floyd. He died on Memorial Day, and we were in the throes of, I don't like to use the word revolution, but it was one of sort. I mean, we had demonstrations and riots and looting and firebombing and arson and the toppling of statues. I mean, remember how crazy it was? It really highlighted, I think, the division that exists in our country. And for some people, marking the 4th was less a celebration. It was more hypocrisy. You know, it was they look at the state as being oppressive. You know, this is a horrific, oppressive state. And after the New York Times, they published the 1619 Project that marked the 400th anniversary of the first slaves arriving in the country. A lot of people accepted that premise, said, oh, no, you know, this nation was not built on Independence Day. It wasn't built on a revolution. It wasn't built on these documents, you know, that Jefferson so eloquently penned. No, it was based and built entirely on slavery. That's the premise behind 1619, that whole project. The premise is really the case, then. If that was the case, then you can understand why people don't feel patriotic. Make you want to turn against the system, right? That's unfortunate. I mean, the New York Times got it wrong, all right? I want you to know that. U.S. is not built on slavery. It is a dark and ugly and horrific chapter. It's a scar on our nation's history. There's a whole lot more to this country than slavery. You know, and being patriotic, though, goes beyond also fireworks and great music, right? I'm joined right now by Monsignor Stuart Sweatland. He's the president of Donnelly College in Kansas City, Kansas. He served our great nation. He is a patriot. He also serves as the executive secretary for the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars, and I always enjoy just talking with him. He's been a great friend of the show and a great contributor to this network. Monsignor, great to have you with me. Good afternoon.
Great to be with you, Drew. I always love the story of Charles Carroll, the only Catholic to sign the Declaration. He's also the only signer to put his address on the Declaration of Independence. And that's because when he signed, Benjamin Franklin is reported to have said, "There are so many Carrolls in Maryland, the king won't know which one to come and hang."
Wow.
And Charles Carroll therefore put his address underneath his name. It's Charles Carroll of Carrollton, which was the name of his manor. And so he made sure that the king would know which one to come to hang, because, of course, all the signers put their honor, their lives, their fortunes on the line when they made that decision to break away from England and become independent.
Yeah, I was blown away. I mean, I was actually reading about him last night, how much wealth he had. and what he was willing to risk. Because you're right, it's not just your wealth and your land, but it's family and it's ultimately your life. I mean, and there were so many of those early signers who lost a lot for this nation. To me, that's heroic virtue. It really was. And the fact that his brother was the first bishop in the New World, that's fantastic.
Yeah, cousins. Yes, cousins. I think they're cousins.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, part of the same family. But yes, and recommended to be the first bishop by Benjamin Franklin, John Carroll, because they had met in a diplomatic journey to Canada. Interesting how the fate of history on that trip, which was by stagecoach, Franklin grew sick, and John Carroll tended to him as a priest. He had been a Jesuit, of course. The Jesuits had been suppressed, and he came to America from England to serve and, you know, became our first bishop, then our first archbishop in the primatial see of Baltimore.
You know, the times that we are living in right now, you know, I was sharing the other day, and throughout the week, you hear these stories about people who want to win a medal so they can burn the flag, you know, before the world. Another woman recently won an event, turned her back on the national anthem. And then we see the tremendous disrespect just in general for authority in this country and really for our history. A lot of men and women served our nation. You're one of those. My daughter was one of those. My father was one of those. A lot of people lost their lives. They shed blood. They made heroic sacrifices like these founding fathers and someone else. How do you view the nation right now? And look, I'm not pessimistic, but I think of what those founding fathers said, that only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. And Monsignor, when I see what's going on from the highest levels of government promoting immorality, I think it was Franklin or it was Adams or it was one of these people who said, you know, as nations become more corrupt, I think it was Franklin, you know, as nations become more corrupt and vicious, they need more masters. And virtue and morality are just a necessary spring of government. That was Washington that said that. We are seeing a time where not virtue, but vice is being promoted, advocated, and legislated. So what do we do to get back to really save the future of the Republic in that respect? And if we don't, we continue down this path, what do you see coming?
Well, Drew, I think it's important that we see that the United States of America is an ongoing experiment in ordered liberty. And all of those terms are important. It's ongoing. And it's an experiment. In other words, it's constantly in need of reformation and improvement to work towards that more perfect union that our founding documents speak about. And, you know, I've been reading a lot recently of the critique and criticism of the United States pre the Civil War by the abolitionist. In particular, I just recently reread the a famous speech of Frederick Douglass on the 5th of July. He would not give it on the 4th of July because as a former slave, you know, he rhetorically asked the question, what to the slave is your 4th of July? And he answered the question, I answer a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty and unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. He goes on in that, as only he could do, that soaring rhetoric that he was most famous for. But even after that critique, and he's speaking this in 1852 in Rochester, New York, he goes on to, he praises the virtues of the founders and said their ideals are wonderful. They just haven't been lived out yet, and they need to be lived out. And then at the end, famously, now this is a speech I kind of envious of him because he got to go on for over an hour, 10,000 words. Wow. We don't get to do that even on this radio. We have to take breaks and things. Yeah, but in that soaring rhetoric, he makes a break from his mentor, William Lloyd Garrison, who Garrison had given up on the American experiment. He famously, a couple years later, Garrison burned a copy of the Constitution because he thought there was no saving America. That was a slave document and there was no saving America. But Douglass actually said, if you read closely, he quotes from the Declaration, but then he talks about the Constitution. He says, if you read closely the Constitution, everything is there that's necessary for us to live as a free people and to abolish slavery. And he was a great believer in the constitutional system. He was a great believer in the Republic, but he knew it needed to be reformed. Now, after the Civil War, of course, Frederick Douglass becomes the first African-American to be made a marshal in the United States. He was Marshal of Washington, D.C. He goes on to be what we would call today ambassador to Haiti. Of course, he was a Republican politician, Frederick Douglass, an appointee by several administrations post-Civil War. But he believed in the goodness of the Republic despite all the injustices that he himself had experienced as a slave who had been tortured and whipped and had to escape and had to run for his life and was always fearful of the Fugitive Slave Act being a danger to him to be re-enslaved. But yet he saw that the genius of the American founding could be reformed if we would pay attention to what others called the better angels of our nature. The good news is those reforms were made in the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution and in the Reconstruction. We didn't live up fully to those with the institution of Jim Crow in the South and the de facto prejudice in the North and segregation in the North. It took years for us to overcome it. But it shows that America can reform itself if we have the will and the vision. Both have to be there, the will to do it and the vision of what a just and good society looks like.
Yeah, my guest, Monsignor Stuart Sweatland, if you want to join us, it's 888-914-9149. Monsignor, stay with me for a second. I'm going to take a real quick break here because I want to give you the time to address this. There was breaking news today. I'm sure you probably heard it, where the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, has suspended federal executions. This is a topic you and I have spoken about a lot. I'd love to get your take on it. Our conversation continues right after this. Stay with us. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The death penalty in America was influenced by England. The first person to be killed in the U.S. was Captain George Kendall in 1608, who was put to death by firing squad for serving as a Spanish spy. Since those early days, various high court rulings have placed limits on the death penalty. In 1972, the Supreme Court declared the death penalty a cruel and unusual punishment that violated the Eighth Amendment. For the next 4 years, no executions were carried out at the state or federal levels. But in 1976, the Supreme Court decided to allow it again, but with appellate review, meaning a higher court must review the decision of lower courts. The death penalty resumed the following year. In the 2000s, Supreme Court rulings abolished the death penalty for young people and people with intellectual disabilities. While the majority of people executed since 1976 have been white, a disproportionate number have been black. Black people make up about 13% of the population, but 42% of people on death row.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app.
Yeah, I found, I didn't realize this, but before the passage of Roe v. Wade, the death penalty had been abolished here in the country. Of course, we saw the Trump administration move forward with it, and now we are hearing news that Attorney General Merrick Garland suspended scheduling of federal executions, suspending them. There's a review right now of some of these lethal injection, the protocol that they use. I had shared a report, I'm sure Monsignor Sweatland was probably the guest, about there's a state in the union, and I forget which one it is right now. They want to bring back the firing squad. What would you take, the electric chair, the firing squad? I mean, how would you like to go to death? I wouldn't like to go any of those ways. And Monsignor, it's good to have you back. Monsignor Sweatland joins us, president of Donnelly College. You and I have been talking about the death penalty for a long time. There's been developments over the years. We know what Pope Francis has recently said. And when I heard that federal executions have been suspended by Merrick Garland, the attorney general, I thought, well, I'd love your perspective on this. What do you think of this? What do you think of the rationale or the what's driving it? And where are we as Catholics on this issue? I know you feel that you're completely opposed to the death penalty. many people will quote the catechism and things along those lines, but I thought it'd be good to maybe do a primer or 101 on this issue too, just for those who might be confused over where to stand on it.
Well, yes, I think as Catholics, if we're following the teaching of the Church, the revision in the catechism at paragraph 2267 now says that the Church teaches in light of the gospel that the death penalty is inadmissible because it's an attack on the dignity of the person. That's not the whole quotation, but I just did part of it. The Catholics should oppose the death penalty. I personally believe it's intrinsically evil because it intends death. The people who are involved in executing criminals have to intend their death, which is a different type of intentionality than what happens in a just war or in a police action, an upright police action, where you don't intend death, you just intend to stop the aggressor from committing a crime of aggression or of threatening or taking the lives of others. In the death penalty, you have to intend the death of the person, which I find morally problematic. It's my personal theological opinion that we should never intend the death of another human being. That covers abortion, it covers euthanasia, it covers the death penalty. So we should oppose it. Now, reasonable Catholics can disagree. Some can just oppose it on practical grounds that we have other means of rendering someone who is a danger. We can render them not a danger anymore by incarceration or other means of keeping them from harming others. So, but whichever reason you might oppose it, Catholics should oppose the death penalty. So they should see this as a positive step that there's now a moratorium on the use of it at the federal level. But this is just a moratorium. It's not doing away with it permanently. And I think it would be better if we permanently did away with the death penalty on the federal level and on the individual state levels. Many states have decided to end the use of the death penalty in their states.
So where do we stand on that? Do you think we'll get there one day? Does it depend on the administration that that's in power? And then secondly, with the culture of death so prominent in our nation today, it's okay to kill a child in the womb or even move towards euthanasia. How likely is it that the death penalty will be seen in a different light?
Well, I'm hoping people see that death is never a solution, Drew. I think that's the problem, that we embrace the idea that death is somehow a solution to our problems. That's what people think put forward an argument for euthanasia or mercy killing, as it's called. Mm-hmm. That's what people put forward the solution of abortion. And that's what people put forward when they argue for the death penalty. They think death is a solution to our problems, be the problem crime or unwanted pregnancy or sickness or suffering at the end of life. Death is never a solution to problems, should not be embraced as a solution to problems, and should not be, should not be used as a so-called solution to problems, because it isn't a solution to a problem. It's another problem in and of itself. And remember what the scriptures say. God did not create death. He did not intend death, at least death as we experience it now. Death came into the world with sin, and we don't want to use that as a so-called solution to our problems. It isn't. It creates even worse problems.
Yeah. Well, Monsignor, thank you for clarity on this issue. We'll continue to talk about it in the days ahead. I'm sure we're going to see more. Do you remember what state it was that was thinking about having the firing squad come back? I think
that was South Carolina. Allow execution by firing squad. I don't think it was. It got very far, but that was a discussion that South Carolina was having.
That's kind of macabre. Hey, enjoy your 4th, and thank you for your service to the country, too, Your Excellency, and for your yes to God. We're delighted to have you here on the air, and you're always welcome.
Well, thank you, Drew, very much. I appreciate always being on the show, and I want to wish everyone a blessed 4th, because to be a true patriot, which means you want, will, and you work for the true good of your nation, is an important Catholic virtue.
Amen to that. Monsignor, pray for us. We'll do the same for you. The chaplain's coming up in about 25 minutes. I'll remember you with my prayers, okay?
Thank you, Drew. God bless.
All right, it's Monsignor Stuart Swetland. He is president of Donnelly College, one of the great voices you used to hear here on the air all the time. And, of course, you ought to check out Donnelly. Great, great institution, and the cost is phenomenal, too. And of course, with a president like Monsignor, how can you go wrong, right? I want to see where you stand on civics and on history. You know, of course, there are a number of schools around the country that are pushing this critical race theory, CRT, basically, in their curricula. And part of it is teaching, for instance, the so-called 1619 Project that I was talking about, the idea that was put forth by the New York Times. It's so silly. It frustrates me. I was having this conversation with one of my producers this morning. I mean, they're arguing America was not founded on July 4th, right? No. Has nothing to do with the approval of the Declaration of Independence, but rather America's roots, everything from 1619, it was all about slavery. When the first ship-bearing slaves in their cargo landed off the coast of Jamestown, Virginia, that's what this is all about. It started in 1619. New York Times got it wrong. I said that earlier, and I'll say it again. The project's being adapted by a lot of school districts across the country, even though it's been panned by history scholars, both from the right and the left. Look, we want to be true to history, right? We don't want falsehood. We don't want myth about our origins, our history. We want truth. So when you've got scholars, you know, both liberal and conservative, panning this whole 1619 project, and yet it's being pushed in curricula. It should give you a pause, and as a parent, you should know what's being taught to your kid. In fact, 2 years before the 1619 Project was even run, Smithsonian, the magazine, which is, you know, no one's idea of right-wing or conservative in terms of its publication, they published an article entitled "The Misguided Focus on 1619 is the beginning of slavery in the U.S. They said damages our understanding of American history." It's a long title, but I stumbled across it the other day. You know, let me repeat it to you again. "The misguided focus on 1619 is the beginning of slavery in the U.S. damages our understanding of American history." Do a search for it, and you can see what Smithsonian had written. But here's part of the problem. I don't think most Americans know their history. I don't think most Americans know their civics. And teaching civics and real history in our country, both it's good and it's bad, as I often say, we have some very dark chapters, shameful chapters. It's essential if we're going to have an informed citizenry. And again, you know, I go back to what Ben Franklin said after that, after the Constitution was drafted, and he was asked, "Hey, what do we have? What kind of government? Monarchy? Republic?" He says, "A republic. If we can keep it, the way you lose the republic is by having citizens who aren't properly formed, who are not informed of their rights and their duties. And if people don't know, let's say, how a bill comes into law, then they're not going to have any idea about how to advocate for bills, you know, that they like, or maybe even fight against bills that they don't like." So just a couple of other things. And I'm going to be joined by Amber Northren, and you're more than welcome to join us too. We'll talk a little bit about this. A couple of other things I think students need to learn, and this is something that I don't think is happening at our higher levels of education in the country. There are some good institutions, so I don't like the broad brush. But I don't think students are learning critical thinking skills, and that's so important today. More than ever, it's important. You know, skills in making good arguments, using reason, rationality, using critical thinking. Without those, you cannot have an informed citizenry. And you can't have a citizenry that can intelligently debate the issues of the day. I look at some of these things and I'm like, how does that make sense? Right? We talked about this yesterday, right? We talked about how, you know, prisons are men are now going into female prisons because they say they want to identify as women, or they're going into gyms and spas, and mothers with their daughters are saying, "Hey, this guy's male genitalia is out and he's a male. What's he doing in here?" And you know, we see this in sports. We see this in a whole lot of other places. And we've talked about gender, and people seem to be very accepting of that. So when a guy comes out, a TikTok star, and says, "I've got a Korean man inside me," and he's changing his body to look Korean and says Korean, if you're going to be, you know, transgender, then why can't you be transracial? And it goes back to, first of all, it's flawed. This doesn't make any sense at all on so many different levels. But if you can't do critical thinking, you begin to accept all this stuff. And I think that's part of the problem. And I think, unfortunately, what's being taught in many places is emotionalism. That's the order of the day. And the more emotional you can make an argument, the better, right? Recently, the Thomas B. Forman Institute ranked states by how well their curricula outlines, by how those outlines help you know, their students actually learn this kind of stuff. And to say that a lot of states aren't doing well, that's an understatement. But Amber Northren is a senior vice president for research at the Institute. And I said, look, you got to stop by. Let's talk about it. Where are we as a country? What's being taught? And how do we get it right? If we want our country to thrive, if we want to keep this great republic, this experiment in order to liberty, then we need well-formed citizenry. Amber, thank you for your time. Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to join this conversation.
Well, I was looking forward to talking you to you about this. I really think we've lost critical thinking in the country. I think the curricula that's being force-fed to some of our kids, you know, in elementary school and in high school, it's frightening. And it affects the next generation. It affects our politicians, our writers, those in medicine and law. And it affects the future of this great country of ours. Tell me a little bit about what you are seeing. What's the overall grade across the country that you came up with? And tell us a little bit about what you analyzed or what you looked at.
Sure. So we were looking at what state policymakers in each state require kids to know in the two subject areas of civics, which is basically the study of government, and U.S. history. And so we came up with criteria that we think most people would agree, whether you're right or left, you know, things like right. the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and so on and so forth, American Revolution, Civil War, things that we think kids need to be exposed to and study. And then we looked to see whether these states had covered some of these critical areas, content, skills.
All right. Amber, stay with me one second. I'm sorry. I just want to take a quick pause. When we come back, we'll pick it up. If you want to join the conversation, you can get in at 888-914-9149. Speaking to Amber Northren, Senior Vice President of Research for a wonderful institute that is taking a look at where we are as a country. Stay with us. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
It's like a civics class on the radio. The Drew Mariani Show. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, thanks for joining me. It's good to talk with you. I'm speaking right now with Amber Northren, Senior Vice President for Research at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. And they just did a state of state standards for civics in U.S. history in 2021. And what they are seeing across the country, I think, is very telling. And look, we've been talking about critical race theory. We've talked about a lot of things that our kids are being exposed to in the past. And Amber, let me pick up on that particular point, and then I'd love to hear how some states have done and what we can do to get this right. How much influence has, let's say, critical race theory had? You know, if somebody doesn't know their history well, this is being taught to them. Is it gaining traction, and who's promoting this, and why? What's the agenda behind that?
Yeah, I think that the good news is we saw very little of critical race theory playing out in the policies at the state level. So in other words, it's a lot in the news, but the phrase critical race theory was actually not in any set of standards that we looked at across the nation. And there were a handful of states that I think, you know, sort of towed the line. I mean, Oregon comes to mind. They have an ethnic studies curriculum that sort of does introduce some of the ideas that folks are particularly concerned about with critical race theory. They do have some of that in their newest standards. But for the most part, we did not see it rearing its head in state standards. It's not to say that it won't, because we've heard from a lot of states since we've released the report saying they're in the midst of reviving and renewing and holding various committees and so forth to discuss revising them. So we're going to keep a watch out, because, you know, it could definitely get worse, but we want it to get better.
So what was the main failing of the states that you graded as mediocre or below? I mean, what are they not doing right?
Yeah, I would say for the most part, they're just vague. Part of the problem with divisive conversations like we're having across the country now is that state policymakers often say, you know what, let's just write really mushy standards so that no one gets offended. Mm-hmm. And so you end up with, you know, something that sounds like explain how policies are developed to address public policy problems, which is a standard, by the way, in Vermont, that really doesn't say anything. What policies are we talking about? What public policy problems? Right. What? Just nothing. And so that's the key. One of the key problems we saw is just that there's just mush.
You know what surprised me? And you know, I want to stand corrected when I'm wrong, and I want to champion states that are doing what's right when they're right. The state of California, I would have thought, would not have had a good right, but you mark them, a good record here, but you mark them as exemplary. So you got to, I want to give props to California for doing something right.
Yeah.
What are they doing right?
It was right and left. The five A's were Alabama, California, the District of Columbia, Massachusetts, and Tennessee. So again, you've got a mixture of right and left leaning states. And I think for California, one of the things they did was just what I was just explaining. They actually gave detailed guidance, and they didn't just give you mush. They named names. They gave examples of events and historical documents that kids needed to be studying. And they didn't, you know, they just didn't try to leave it to local districts completely. They gave some guidance that then local districts could fill in the blanks. So, yes, that was surprising for us, too. Some states that we thought might not get it right did.
Yeah, well, look, I am grateful for your time and for what you've done there. If people want to view the full report, where's the best place to go? FordhamInstitute.org or what would
That's
you recommend?
That's it, FordhamInstitute.org. It's right there on our website, and folks can click on their state if they want to see how their state did.
So kind of final thoughts here. Are you hopeful about the future of curricula in the country, or do we have a lot of work to do?
I'll say I'm ambivalent. I think it matters a lot, the folks that are going to come together and, you know, decide we want a factual history, we want an accurate history, we don't want to politicize history. You know, if you have to put, you know, conservative or liberal in front of the word civics, then it's not really civics. We want this, we want to tell the story of our nation, and we don't want it to be clouded with ideology. And if people come together with that intention in mind, then they can write good standards. But if they don't, they're going to write mush, or they're going to write ideology, which we don't want to see.
You got it. Hey, well, thank you so much for your time today. Enjoy your 4th, okay? Have a happy Independence
you
Day.
You too. Happy Thanks. Independence Day.
Thanks, Amber.
Bye-bye.
It's Amber Northen. Check her out. Check out the report there, FordhamInstitute.org. You can get up to speed on that. And it's good to have her here with us today. And it gives you hope. I want to look at both those issues. You know, we're going to take a break here in just a second. When I come back, of course, we'll pray the chapel at the top of the hour. But before we do that, I want to share with you just a little bit more on our founding fathers, a little bit more on this great nation that we have. Yeah, there's a lot of problems. You know, we have lost a lot of virtue. There is a lot of vice. There are some problems in our educational institutions, but there's hope. There really is. We still are the greatest nation in the world. There's no doubt in my mind about that. You know, you and I enjoy freedom and liberties that many people around the planet we'll never know. And a lot of men and women have made great sacrifices so that we can do that. And that's why it frustrates me to no end when I see people disrespect our flag, when I see them threaten to burn it or turn their back on our anthem. And I know we can debate freedom of speech and a whole lot of other things and other agendas. But I think when you represent our country, you represent all Americans, you know, not just one particular political ideology or you represent how great our country really is. Those who signed this Constitution, I spoke a little bit about Thomas Carroll earlier today. I don't know if you ever followed up, wondered, or went back and read about the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence. Five signers were actually captured by the British as traitors, and they were tortured, and they died. 12 had their homes ransacked and burned. Can you imagine that? 12 of them. 2 lost their sons during the Revolutionary War. Another had 2 sons captured. 9 of the 56 fought and died from wounds or some sort of hardship during the Revolutionary War. And they signed, they pledged their lives, they pledged their fortunes, they pledged their sacred honor to this great republic that we have here today. So what kind of men were they? I think it's such a great question. 24 of them were lawyers and jurists. 11 were merchants. 9 were were farmers and large, plantation owners. They were men of means and well-educated. I talked a little bit about Thomas Carroll, who had a lot to lose by putting his name on the Declaration of Independence. He's worth, in our own dollars today, $500 million. He's worth $2 million in 1776 dollars. But all of these signers, they signed the Declaration of Independence knowing very well that the penalty for this action would mean not just the loss of their property and their wealth, but it would be death if they were captured. Carter Braxton of Virginia was a very wealthy planter and trader. He saw his ships swept from the sea by the British Navy. He sold his home and his properties to pay for his debts, and then he died in rags. A man of wealth and means died in poverty. Thomas McKean was so hounded by the British that he was actually forced to move his family almost constantly. And he served in the Congress without pay. His family was kept in hiding. His possessions were taken from him. You know what his reward was? Poverty. Vandals or soldiers, they looted properties of Dillery and Hall and Walton and Hayward and Rutledge, Middletown and others. You had the Battle of Yorktown. Thomas Nelson Jr., actually, he noted that the British General Cornwallis had taken over Nelson's home for his headquarters, so he quietly urged George Washington, General Washington, to open fire. His home was destroyed. Nelson, too, died bankrupt. I'll give you one more story or one more account, maybe two. Francis Lewis was another one who had his home and his properties destroyed. They jailed his wife. The enemy jailed his wife. Imagine that. You know, here you are. You're losing your home, your property, all for this vision, this new government, this great experiment in order to liberty, right? Your wife is arrested, jailed. She died within a few months. John Hart was driven from his wife's bedside as she was dying. Their 13 children fled for their lives. His fields, his grist mill, was laid to waste. And more than a year, he lived in forests and caves, returning to find his wife dead and his children vanished. A few weeks later, he died. They say he died from exhaustion and a broken heart. Norris and Livingston, they suffered very similar fates. But these are stories. These are the sacrifices of the American Revolution. These were not wild-eyed, rebel-rousing, ruffians. You know, they're not sitting around having a few drinks in the local pub and thinking, all right, let's go up against Britain, one of the greatest naval powers of the day. These were soft-spoken men. These were educated men. Men of means. They had a lot to lose. They had security. But you know what? Here's the thing. This is what moves me by their legacy. They valued liberty more than the security they had, more than the wealth that they had, more than any of that. They valued freedom. Standing tall, standing straight, unwavering, they pledged for the support of the Declaration. They believed, they said this, they actually said, let me just quote what they say. They said, with firm reliance on the protection of the divine providence, God, right, God's divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. These heroic men will celebrate this weekend. They gave you and they gave me a free and independent America. I know the history books probably never told you a lot about what happened in the Revolutionary War. We didn't, fight just British, right? We were actually British subjects at the time, if you think about it. We were British subjects. We fought our own government. That's what happened. These people said enough is enough. No taxation without representation. They had enough. We take these liberties today. We take them so much for granted. And it gives me pause. It really does. I want to pray. When we come back, let's pray for this. Let's pray for our country. Let's pray for those who take these liberties for granted. We shouldn't. Let's pray for virtue so that the vice that seems to be rising in our culture can be vanquished. Let's pray Thanksgiving for this great gift of the United States of America that God has given us. We are blessed from sea to shining sea. You know, this weekend, as you celebrate the 4th of July, as you celebrate the holiday with friends or family, with fireworks, with cookouts, whatever it may be, you know, remember that freedom's never free. And give thanks to those men and women, not just those signers of the Declaration of Independence, the framers of our Constitution, the men and women who fought countless wars, who sacrificed across the centuries for our freedoms. Remember, freedom is never free. Let's give thanks to them. All right? Let's give thanks to God. It's time to get the word out that patriotism is not a sin. Patriotism is not a sin. All right? Be patriotic. Let's pray for a real renewal in patriotism in our country. And the 4th is more than beers and picnics and baseball games, isn't it? It's about God's providence and a nation that I am proud to say I'm a citizen of.